Can you hear me?
No.
No? Okay, well, some of us were talking about this strange intimacy between this object and my lips. And I wonder a little bit about how we're doing as a conference. And I was just having a little chat with Andrew. I suspected him of having some sort of subversive intent in putting this conference on. In fact, he's just acknowledged a little bit of it, but it's not what I anticipated. I think there are important differences here, and maybe that got stirred up before lunch. But there's also, I think our conceptual clothes keep us more distinct than maybe we are. Now, Dale and I wanted to do something a bit different, which we had tried once before. In sort of keeping with a conversational style, we would like just to have a conversation. It's quite anxiety-making just to have a conversation. So we originally had thought that we'd each start separately and then open it to you and then come back. Unfortunately or fortunately, my computer crashed 2 days ago with all my notes in it. It's a little opportunity in there, a little message in there. A little bit of a cheat because I sent Dale an email a couple of weeks ago about some possibilities. So I did have a record of that. But otherwise, I think I'm being forced, as it were, to be true to the aim, which is what if we drop out of what we know about? What if we move from the maps to the territory? There's been a lot of map talk I've heard this morning, and even Stephen, very lovely, clear talk, but Steve, you talked about lovely concepts. The enantiodroma, the paradoxical change, created a difference, has lovely concepts. Well, enantiodroma probably is an idea, but creative indifference is a practice. And that's a very important distinction. And I think of myself, we have practitioner research. I'm wondering if we ought to have a new division called practitioner therapists, who are less concerned with the conceptual background we come from. Now, how do we identify ourselves? I hear a lot of branding going on. We identify ourselves through the brand. And I can feel myself getting a bit upset right now. Maybe we have sacrificed our, dare I call it, spiritual craft into an industry where we all have to be branded with certain frames of reference, but perhaps behind that we actually do share some very important practices. So what I'm going to try and do, maybe before I say what I'm going to try and do, a lot of things we don't have time to do, which I'll just look at my jottings here. I think if we're going to be radical, which is what our talk is about, we're going to have to do some deconstruction and releasing ourselves from a lot of sacred concepts. Growth would be a key one for humanistic therapy, especially in our present age. Growth is a perverse concept because we should be talking about sustainable centres. This relational. Several people talked about the move to relational therapy, and one of you defined it as is between two people. Well, my relational therapy includes other beings, other animals, and things. I mean, if I'm going to work in my consulting room, that's already an assumption. That I hope when we have two rounds of this, we might get round to. Maybe the consulting room is one of these precious cows we need to release ourselves from. Now, for some clients, for some patients, some of the time, that's perfect. But all of the time, maybe this is part of our need and our security that we go into this little box. I don't know if some of you got that circular from someone like Rwanda about that they had to send some of the therapists back because rather than taking people outside into the sunshine where they could warm up and dance and drum and feel a bit of joy, they took them into these dingy rooms and had forced them to talk about all the bad things that happened to them. So, any of you receive that? It's a great little sort of cultural shock about what we do. So, maybe not a consulting room, maybe not even love. Or perhaps we have to work a little bit about our understanding about love. However, the two things I'm wanting to focus on, one is about knowledge, and the other is about language. My paradigm case about knowledge came when I was studying family therapy, and Salvador Minuchin was the flavour of the year. I went to his conference, and after a talk, he was going to work live with a family, and the social worker came on to brief him about the family, and after 30 seconds, suddenly she said, "Stop! I've met this family 1,000 times before." And everyone went, "Wow." And I had a very uneasy feeling. And afterwards I thought about it, no you haven't. You have never met this family before. And that's the presuppositions that when we're experienced so often, we think we know, and we don't. Because the phenomenon is what's scary. So, I'm thinking that our knowledge about, our explicit knowledge, is part of what we use to defend ourselves against the uncertainty and the anxiety of being present to the moment. And I think a lot of psychotherapy training is about giving people these clothes, giving people these models, so they don't have to face into the terror of that moment. And of course they're very grateful to receive it. However, this week I had a training group, and we started with a check-in, as we might do, and I could feel a conversation starting. People were not sort of checking, they were commenting on each other. And rather than break that, I thought feels interesting. And in fact, we spent the full time just having a spontaneous conversation, in which, with one time in particular, that seemed like a digression. Somebody was talking about a film, and the conceptual part of me saying, you know, this is not in the frame. But actually, as the conversation about the film deepened, we all dropped into this much more soulfully connected place that could never have been predetermined, predicted, or controlled. And I think that that's, I'm not saying that's right for all of the time, but that could be a model we could allow more.
That's 10 minutes.
Okay, two very brief quotes on this then. One is my favourite one from Hillman. The uncertainty of what you and I are here for is what we are here for. And, okay, I'll leave it at that. There's beyond is... There's a lot more to be said about beyond, but over to you.
Thanks, Chris. When we planned this together over many lunches and lots of beers, we thought that I would start by doing a headstand to demonstrate to you the journalists turn things on their head. But I just had my lunch, so we dropped that one. What we're actually doing is a kind of improvisational jazz with ideas. And the reason that we're doing that is because music is probably one of the best metaphors for what actually goes on in our work. You don't have a theory for jazz, you just do it. So if we can keep in mind music as a metaphor, that would be a good start. I thought I'd begin by saying how I got into this crazy kind of work. It was very strange. I was 15. I was one of the best mathematicians at school. And one morning I woke up and I couldn't do fractions. I couldn't really even add up. I went to see my tutor, and I was in a right old state. And he listened to me for a long time, over several weeks, and gave me a book to read. And the book was Memories, Dreams, Reflections. I read it 5 times, and I realized that what I wanted to be when I grew up was a Jungian analyst. This is a work in progress, both the growing up and becoming a Jungian analyst. I really understood that Jung knew about the inner world and how disturbed and strange it was, because when I read what he wrote, it sounded like where I was. So I thought I could explore the inner world and it would make kind of sense. The thing that was most important when I was in that very lost space was the idea of the collective unconscious. Because when I was a kid, I grew up on an island called Iona. Some of you may have been there. And in those days, it was a proper commune run by communists who were also Christians. So the idea that you could be two different things at the same time was actually what was part of my natural world. I realized that there were lots of different versions of me, and that there were lots of different versions of all the different people who made up the community. And in fact, there must be lots of different versions of everybody else. It was only when I left the island that I began to realize that not everybody thought like this. This was very strange. So our radical idea number one is the word self. First of all, it is the name of a concept. It is not the name of a thing. Self is a concept. It's a member of the class of concepts. It is not a member of the class of things. So when people start telling me how they're going to define it, I'm thinking that they've lost it somewhere. They've forgotten that we're talking about a concept. Second, self, if it is anything, is a collective. Self is a collective. So the idea that I have is that we are all a collective, and that's why the psyche is and has to be political. Because you can't have an agreement in a collective unless you're using the art of the possible. How could you? Second thing is, and we'll do an exercise about this in a minute, is that self is distributed over space and time. When I look back on my progress, or whatever it has been in this field, I think of how I first met psychosynthesis, which was through the Scientific and Medical Network back in the 70s, when two people who knew Asagioli very well introduced us children to his ideas. And when I met the idea of subpersonalities, or that I am a collective, again, I thought, yes, I'll train with that. So I did. Analysis or therapy or whatever it is that we do is about our own inner world and the way that that interacts with the inner world of others and the way that those two interrelated inner worlds interact with the collective. It's like playing jazz, isn't it? When we meet someone, we want to know what they play, what tunes can we play together. We're really trying to make music together. And making jazz means dealing with uncertainty, because you just don't know what's going to come out. Just like in this particular experience, I have no idea what on earth you're going to get from it, and I'm not quite sure what I'm going to. It's a constant surprise. You have a few certainties, you riff around with them, and then off you go. One of the things that we use to make these creative riffs is the symbol. So my second radical idea is that all an analyst actually does is play with symbols. That analysis is about the formation and the use of symbols and creating a safer place in which we can play with symbols. What does this look like? When I was a little boy, I thought that a symbol meant it was a sign plus X, where X is an unknown. And if I worked very hard, I could solve the equation for X. I'm sure you've all done that, haven't you? It's like, it's your mother. You know, all symbols mean it's your mother. Now I've discovered that actually a symbol is a sign plus I, where I is the value of an indeterminate number. Indeterminate numbers are numbers that are placeholders in an equation. So you drop them out at the end. You don't have to know what they are, you just have to put them in there, like a theory, and then you drop it at the end. So that's an idea that was picked up by this psychoanalyst Ignacio Matty Blanco, who wrote about the unconscious as infinite sets. It's always very difficult to say that because most people think you've said infinite sex, which would be quite nice. So, a symbol is an ambiguous thing. Here are some stories about symbols that got made up in my consulting room. This is illustrating Chris's point about you don't just have to be human to do this. The first one is this. A patient dreams. They wake up and they go downstairs. The dream is, there is a white fox sitting on my back doorstep. When they wake up, they go downstairs. There is a white fox sitting on their doorstep. Second dream, it's one of my own. I dreamed that someone gives me a stone that's full of bright colours. It's green and it's gold and it's got a silver bit in the middle. This was early in my first analysis. I go to Covent Garden after the analytic session, and it's there. Here it is. Okay? This was in my dream. I found it in a shop the next day. You can all come and have a look at it afterwards if you want. The third one. This is a piece of work with a patient who had a very strong sense of not belonging. They felt they were a crow. The only people that they could talk to would be the crows. So I gave them a copy of Ted Hughes' book, The Song of the Crow, to read. Come to a session, they've been reading the book, they go out, they go and sit in the park, a crow comes up to them, and they spend 4 hours talking to the crow in pure crow. They didn't know that they spoke crow, but they did. And they then bring that back to the next session. So we try and do a session in crow, which is quite difficult to be sort of kind of noise. So you don't actually need words to do this job. What you need is the ability to listen. And we've had an awful lot of theory, and I'm with Chris really, that the theory is fascinating, but they are only concepts. What we actually need to do is to listen, like my tutor listened to me when I was a very disturbed kid.
Like you still are.
Thank you, Chris, and I'll hit you afterwards. It's about how you approach the unconscious. Jung was asked at the seminar in Bailey Island in 1938, Dr. Jung, how do we approach the unconscious? And he fell about laughing. It's in the transcript. And he said, look, if there was a cave of hungry bears on this island, how do you think I would ask you to approach it? You wouldn't. You let it come to you. So we get in the way of letting the unconscious approach us when we have all these busy theoretical narratives and discourses. We pretend they're theories. We don't really actually use theories. People have said some curious things about Buddhism today. And as a Buddhist, I would like to just remember that Buddha said, listen, trust your experience. Please do not ever believe a word I say. Try it for yourself. That's in the Mahayana. I'll give you the quote for it afterwards. Another example of this obsession with theorizing is the current fashion for neuroscience and developmental psychology. They really do make such pretty patterns, don't they? They're so pretty. I'm afraid I don't really believe either of them. It reminds me of advertising jingles I used to watch on the television when I was a 15-year-old. It's like, at last we can bring you new, iconic, improved psychotherapy, enriched with nourishing, marrow-bone neuroscience. Or, yes, here is new, improved turbo psychotherapy with an army of underwater developmental enzymes which will leave your psyche whiter than white. We love identifying with discourses, but we can't really help it because it gives our sense of being something to hang on to, a little flag that we can wave. they create an illusion of uncertainty. My colleagues in Asia and other analytic groups recently wrote a book called Alchemy and Psychotherapy, in which we're really trying to deconstruct these modernist narratives of neuropsychology and development and go back to a very old-fashioned idea, the idea of the alchemy, that alchemy is a science that's not a science. It's a science of metaphors. When my colleagues and I use alchemical metaphors, do you know, we know we're talking nonsense. We know that there are no such things as matter confusers. There's no such thing as an alchemical vat. These are just concepts. They are not things. So part of what we're trying to do today is to all of us put down this idea of clinging to concepts and mistaking them for things. Because if we do that in our own heads, we're going to do it with our patients. And that's not a good idea. And we're going to do it with ourselves, which is even worse. So I'm going to have to shut up in a minute because Chris has said it's time to. Thank you, Chris. But what we'd like to do before we open this up for a big discussion is to give you the chance to have a play with the idea of the collective and the politics in your own psyche. Okay? What we'd like to ask you to do, I get to do this because I'm a humanistic psychotherapist as well, sneakily. Okay, let's all pretend we're humanistic psychotherapists. So relax, close your eyes, and go inside. You've all done this hundreds of times. If you don't want to, I don't mind. Just close your eyes and go inside for a second. Go with your lunch. Go with those nice abdominal feelings that Bridget was talking about. Birgit was talking about earlier. Get in touch with your body. Now, can you see in your mind's eye all the people who hold a part of yourself? See in your mind's eye all the people who hold a part of yourself. Maybe start with your friends, your family, and then go outwards. Go outwards as far as you can. Now go backwards. Go backwards as far as you can. Who has held yourself? Who held you? Let it go as wide as you can. Notice how you're held in a culture. Notice how you're held. Okay, now could you open your eyes again? And could you talk for a minute or two with someone next to you about who holds you? because that's talking about yourself. Okay, you've got 5 minutes to have a chat with the people sitting next to you.
I'm going to talk about this.
Okay. These are, of course, dangerously Buddhist implements. Okay, so let's hear from you for a bit. Would somebody go be a kind soul and wander around with a microphone?
Where's the other one?
It would be really nice to have some responses. How that was for you.
Psychosynthesis, integrative psychosynthesis trained, and a tutor at Revision for a decade, but that was about a decade ago. And I found initially quite a resistance I came across, but I wasn't held. Nobody held me. And then up came, well, actually, I've had to hold myself, and then I went beyond that, and I realised that actually, in the not holding that my parents could do of me, other families, my dog, nature, because I was a wild child, I was up trees, I was outdoors, and you could look at that psychologically and say, oh dear, poor thing, why didn't she want to be at home? And that's true too. But actually, I found also I was looking at, in terms of going beyond myself, yes, artists have become a part of myself, people that have helped me and that I've cared for and cared for me have helped me, people who have been really important in my thinking. Germaine Greer, I guess, was the first one that came into my orb about being a woman and what that actually meant as opposed to what my mother thought it meant. And going from there and recognising too, the other piece I think that was a bit interesting for me was it wasn't just about my own culture. I think Dale, you said culture, in your culture, and I actually realised that my initial few weeks and early months in life was actually, I was literally held in the arms of an ayah, or I can't think of what she would be called, in Thailand, because that's where I was born. And of course I then began thinking about her family, her culture, and that huge relationship that we are all part of. And that was quite mind expanding to realise that it wasn't just poor old mommy and daddy that was holding me, it was actually a woman from another culture who was offering me her breast when my mother couldn't offer me hers.
Thank you.
I didn't expect to just put my hand up then, but it has to carry on from what I think it was Rowan just said, that I felt similar discomfort in looking at who held me. And it wasn't until I went to where Dale said about community, and my husband's Indian, and instantly his family flashed to my mind. And then I imagined being in the middle of a spider's web, and his family quite close, because they're very community based, and suddenly this spider's web just grew, and it was held by virtually the whole world, and I was in the middle of the spider web, and as I breathed in, I lifted up and I felt down, and it felt very, very holding.
I was very struck by the people and the things that I didn't think of. I didn't think of any of my therapists. And I was really interested in what you were saying earlier about, there was something I was going to say actually after John was speaking about the thingness, because the thing that's always struck me is having trained in for 4 years in human analysis and leading that training for a few years, but also been humans training beforehand. a big difference for me, in very simple terms, in terms of this sort of concept of self, is that I've always struggled with the humans have this sort of idea of the self being a thing, like a solid entity, like there's this self that can be discovered and actualized. Whereas I like the vagueness of your life, it's brilliant about it. The paradoxical idea of self being the center and the center. I mean, it's a connective thing as well as a personal thing. But I'm using the word thing, I won't have to go on there. I just wanted to say that.
Mention the NHS because I've not been blood born in the NHS and I was before. And my mother was a nurse at the time. And she came over in the 50s. Can you, is that better?
Yes.
Doesn't seem to go around the corner when it's over here, so she just yelled. Sorry.
Okay, I'm yelling about the NHS. As a holding.
You're right.
And as many of my patients are held now in the NHS, where I now work. So not only was I born in that, not only did it save my mother and all the money she owed there paying for me to go to school. it's a tremendously holding part of our society. And the attachment to it is goes very deep. So I just want to, that's one of the things that came up for me. Thank you.
Any more?
Somebody in there. Yeah, behind you.
They're behind you.
I danced out for quite a bit of that, and I realised it was because I wasn't held as a child, but what did hold me was stories. And it was only much later, once I began my training, and particularly looking at it from a Jungian perspective and the ideas around myth, that I realised that these stories that held me as a child had an incredibly powerful mythic basis to them, which was quite extraordinary to me when I reread them as an adult. And the other things that helped me were the animals in my life. My two cats when I was at a very, very low point in my life. And actually also I'm held now by nature. When I go for walks early in the morning with my dog, I'm held by watching the sunrise come up. That's what holds me. So is my beloved dog.
We could easily go on doing this for the rest of the afternoon, couldn't we? It's very moving indeed that those of us who did not have the experience of being held by one or two parents have been able to make contributions. Because you'll understand, of course, if you grow up in a commune, it means you've got about 40 or 50 mums and dads, but actually you don't have any at all. What we thought we would like to do next is between us say one or two things about the consequences of experiencing self as a container that is a concept that exists in the collective, mainly because Jung was extraordinarily clear about this, that you cannot individuate, whatever that might mean, unless there is a relationship between you as a self and the collective, and that that is an extraordinarily deep and inevitable political discussion. Over to you, Chris.
Thank you. One of the things we haven't maybe quite achieved here is a flow. So hopefully there'll be some flow here, but it's also all right to interrupt.
Yes, please, shout at us.
Or just put your hand up. I think one of the things I object to in our present climate is this, the use of Latin technical terms rather than telling stories which somehow embed and allow the flow to move on. We might use, especially from psychopathology, we might use terms that have got a medical background to them. And sometimes I find with supervisees, because of confidentiality, they don't give the client's name. The shorthand is to give a label. And now the client's not even been stripped of their name, but they're being classified, they're being objectified. And that abstract language is so different than if I invite them to tell a story about their client or a story about how their client has impacted them. So this question of professionalisation of our language is really important.
One of the things that Chris and I were talking about in the little bit where you were doing the exercise was, should we ask you all to put up your hands if you're borderline, or should we all ask you to put up your hands if you're narcissistic? We decided that we wouldn't do this because both of us would have to have both our hands up for both of these. But that's really what we meant. It's so insulting, isn't it, when somebody comes in and they speak about the borderline that I saw this morning, or the narcissist that I saw this afternoon. How is that ecologically sound? How is that respectful? Why do we do this? We do it because we don't want to get near the pain, really, don't we? Because we're not sure that we can offer any kind of holding or containing. Someone's going to end up great.
I feel shocked that you allow your supervisees to come into the room and talk about the people they're working with in that way. I always use names when I talk about the people I'm working with, and I encourage my supervisees to use names because I'm working with people. And I don't know how you can condone that or allow it. Or, I don't know, why don't you?
I think I was mentioning it in order not to condone it. I was offering a critique. Perhaps that escaped you.
Who does it? Who are you saying that does it?
I know you're offering a critique, Chris, but it suggests that it happens to you. And I don't know how come you have supervisees that think it's okay to talk to you like that.
They can talk how they like. They come in, they use words that they want to use. You can't stop them, but you can get into a dialogue about it.
There's something about the climate you create, isn't it? There's a co-creation of condition and climate. There's something about the climate that one creates as a supervisor. There's a set of conditions that you co-create with your supervisees. So even if they do say borderline, rah, 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 you open up a conversation in order for something else to happen.
Yes. I just wanted to say that at the moment I'm supervising a group where one of the clients is referred to as the sheep shearer, which is rather beautiful actually, even though it is a label. So I think some labels have an incredibly creative quality to them.
Yeah,
Chris,
I think you're right.
Pick over there for
us. Speaking here.
I said, what would happen if it was sheep shagger?
Yeah, well, that would be nice.
at the risk of trying to make everything kind of nicey-nicey, which I know is also always very dangerous, I'd just like to highlight something that's tonight for me in the last 5 minutes, which in my perception is a commonality of humanistic approaches and Jungian approaches, which is they are both trenchantly anti-medical model. And I think that's enormously important common ground that both of the approaches actually hold.
I mean, although you say that, my experience being trained at Metamoya and in the training office is the huge reliance and elevation of the whole DSM-3 and DSM-4, now DSM-5, unbelievably so. And it seems to come from the idea that this makes us more professional, that this makes us more somehow better
because we're humanistic, we have something real to offer, i.e. we can talk about all these spurious diagnoses. And one of the things I saw recently, which I really liked on a, I think it was one of the IRP emails, was psychopathology. Psychopathology. Well, does that suggest there's such a thing as no pathology? What is no pathology? If there's a term called psychopathology, then is there something called no pathology condition?
Well, we just heard a talk on sanatology.
The point about GSM is it's intended for psychiatrists. DSM is a psychiatric document. And it's absolutely no use to psychologists.
Agreed.
It has no point at all. It's not our language. It's not our concept being used. Leave it to the psychiatrist, I say. I absolutely refuse to use it.
Someone here.
Chris Dick Fogel, I'm trained in integrative psychosynthesis and energy psychologist. Psychotherapist or whatever you label, but as labels as well. I realised that one of the things that holds me in the terminus of my room, my room, is that when it's the energy field, or whatever you call it, you walk into that room and everyone feels something very special in it. I'm not trying to drive here, it just is filled with something. And I don't know whether it's not the objects, it might be some of the objects and what they carry, the artifacts or tokens. It might be some of the works of art, it might be the quotes. But I've been working with people in that room for a long time. So it's what they bring in, it's what my invisibles bring in, the guides and helpers, whatever is around. And it's kind of very perceptive. People come in, even when they're not clients or my supervisors, and they feel something. I don't know how else to say it. And that room has a healing quality, and it holds me, and I'm held in it, and it's something other, and it's soulful, and it's beautiful, and it's dark, and it's uncertain, and it's all of those things. It's very human. And politics come into the room as well. And I was an adoptee, so by Kleinian standards, I should be utterly, utterly fucked up, excuse my language. But I was held by energy, by empathy, by compassion, by qualities that come through. And that's just built up and built up. And my belief in the sacred, or my experience of the sacred, it's not a belief, it's the experience of it. And people go into that room and they experience that. And the work works. And it works through me, not because of me.
One of the nice things about sitting at the front, is this work?
No.
Push the button.
Push the button. Push gently the button.
Push.
Can you see a button that says push? No. Push. One of the nice things about sitting at the front is that it does mean we get the chance to interrupt again. Chris and I were thinking, well, what do we do next in this little improvisation? What we've noticed, you see, is that once we give you permission to start operating as a collective, guess what happens? You start operating as a collective.
Yes.
Isn't that extraordinary? You see, there's this terrible urge that we get that we have to do something. I used to be a doctor. I was just given my certificate, which is very nice. I used to be a psychiatrist. I just handed that one in as well. They were very good, made a lot of money having both of those things. But it's really nice not to have them anymore. And one of the nicest things about it is that I don't have to use the kind of descriptive language that I used to, as John Rowan very kindly commented earlier. When I was a shrink, I had to give people labels, that's the job. Now I'm not, I don't have to. And one of the labels that I think it would be quite nice that if we could pick up from this kind of discussion would be that we're members of a collective. It's called the collective of human beings. We're a kind of human being that do a rather special kind of listening task. And as a former party member, with Mummy and Daddy who were in the party, and Dad who was a shop steward in the AEU, which was a communist union, one of the things I have never understood is why there is no trades union amongst psychotherapists. There isn't, is there? There's lots of little organisations that do this and do that and do the other, and an exciting theoretical wrangles about God knows what. But there isn't a trade union. Is that because we're all so highly individuated that we can't actually agree to agree about anything? Or is it that we don't need a trade union because we're all omnipotent and can take care of ourselves? I've been in shit with various things in my career. The British Medical Association, my trade union, the greatest sort of might. And when I was worked at a university, the AUT was my union, and they were really good as well. And one of you spoke about the NHS and how we all rely on it. That's another kind of union. That's a collective union to work for health. What is it about our trade that means we are unable to do the simple, ordinary, working class thing of unionise? Why can't we do that? Why can't we engage in politics as a group? Andrew and various other people have been very active in doing that. Chris and I are very concerned about eco-psychology, and like most ex-Marxists, I've joined the Green Party. That's the inner green side. I stand for Lambeth Council on a regular basis. I'll never be elected, but so what? But I would really encourage you to be politically active, which means join a political party, join a trade union, work together, get engaged in the collective, because that actually is where the experience of self and selfing happens. It's not just in one's own individual psyche. It's between us as a group, which is why doing this has been such a worthwhile exercise. Because if we haven't done anything else, we've actually demonstrated that 200 of us can sit down in a room and bicker and argue constructively. I think that's just about us out of time. Chris, your go.
Well, I think there's things we can do about our language, both in the consulting room and when we're trying to reflect and write about it afterwards. So one of the just quick translations into process language, rather than talking about depression, how about sinks down into the underworld heavy with grief. I think that's one of the things I'm trying to do in writing. I'm just going to read just a couple of paragraphs from a description of work with client. It's possible here. I sit opposite my client, Andrew. We've sat here before, like two persons coming to invoke a presence or await a higher authority. We wait for that wind to blow through us. He sighs, more in anticipation than resignation, as the words find their way to his speech. I feel a slight tightening of my muscles, my animal senses reaching out for what might be emerging between us. It's as if we're on a tracking session together, smelling the wind and attempting to read the half-hidden signs.
So you can see that for both of us, the thing that intrigues us is this capacity to be with not knowing. To be with not knowing, not knowing what we're doing, not knowing what is going to emerge into the field. But just like people watching animals, knowing that they will emerge. And usually when something emerges in our clients, the same thing is evoked inside ourselves. Thank you.
really wonderful. Can I invite all the speakers to now come back up here so we can have a plenary?